Everyone, this is your one and only personal astrophysicist Rohit Agrawal, and I bring a brand new episode for our podcast Astrophysica. And this is basically the third episode of our season number 3, which is dedicated to stars. And in this particular episode, we'll be discussing about characteristics of stars. In the previous episode, we had two of our researchers from our team, and we discussed about compact stars. In the first episode, we had Molly Wells with us, a PhD scholar from UK, and we discussed about star formation. Today, we have with us two of our science communicators from our Astrophysica's team, Aman Mohan and Krishna. So, hi Aman.
Hey Rohit, thanks for having me, man. So guys, before we start, can I ask you both a question? Has any one of you heard about a woman named Annie Jump Cannon?
I certainly haven't heard about her, and I think most of our listeners might also be unaware about her contribution that's about her. So it would be great if you can elaborate.
Well, sure. And honestly, I'm not surprised because she was a woman scientist during the early 1900s. And as you know, that was a time when men ran the show. And she is the reason we are able to record this episode today. She was the first to analyze the spectral data and create stellar spectral classes based on the wavelengths of visible UV and infrared radiations. So don't worry, that's not all. I'll definitely come back to her later. But since we are discussing the features of stars today, Krishna, why don't you start with the basic feature of any star, color?
Hey Aman, thanks for giving me this opportunity. So let's look at the color first. As we know, stars come in range of colors from reddish to yellowish to blue. When we observe a star, it might appear to us as having a single color, but it actually emits a broad spectrum of colors, potentially including everything from radio waves and infrared rays to ultraviolet beams and gamma rays. As we know, different element or compound absorb and emit different colors or wavelength of light. And by studying the star spectrum, one can interpret what its composition might be. To do this, astronomers use spectrograph to find out what elements are in a star. A spectrograph is a device that breaks light into colors. Scientists usually compare a star's light with the light produced by a different element to find out more about what elements are in the star. A star's color also gives us clues about star's temperature. The coolest star appears red and the hottest star appears blue. Amal, why don't you tell us more about the surface temperature?
Sure, but before that, color is a really important feature of a star when it comes to determining the star's temperature, chemical composition, etc. I mean, it's amazing, right? Everything we know about such a massive celestial body like a star is determined from a simple property like its color. So now let's see how this temperature is measured. As you already know, stars have different layers, right? So the surface temperature of a star is measured at a layer called the photosphere and is dependent on the star's diameter and the rate of energy production in the stellar core. The photosphere is actually an outer shell of the star and light is radiated from it. This is what we actually see when we gaze at the sun in white light. We perceive the surface of the sun. You might have seen these images, right, of sunspots and all. We see these sunspots and faculae, which are bright, tiny cloud-like objects in the photosphere when we look at them. And there's a law that helps us determine the surface temperature of a star, and it is called the Wien's displacement law, which is actually a relation between wavelength and the temperature. We actually measure the brightness using two filters. There's a red filter and a blue filter. And then we compare the ratio of red to blue light. And then we compare the spectra of computer models of stellar spectra at different temperatures. And an exact color temperature relation can be developed. And this color of a star is known as the color index, which is actually a measurement of its surface temperature. And the whole credit for this color temperature relation goes to Annie Jump Cannon. Actually, there's a story behind Annie's discovery of these classifications. Long back, Harvard was a place for men, right? But there was this astronomer named Edward Charles Pickering who assigned a team of women to map and classify the types of stars, and Annie Jump Cannon was one of those women. She had lost her hearing at a very young age, and she explained how they were classifying these stars. The light from these stars is passed through a prism placed in the telescope. And when it's magnified, the starlight splits up into a band showing its component colors. This is called the spectrum of a star, and you can see some fine dark lines in this band. And it is by comparing these dark fine lines, we are able to find the chemical composition of the stars. And Annie discovered that the stars she studied fell into a sequence of 7 broad categories according to the spectral lines I just mentioned before. And these stellar types were O, B, A, F, G, K, and M. And there's actually an easy way to remember this classification that's pretty common. Just remember the sentence, "Oh boy, a fat girl kicked me." The first letter of each word should give you the seven classes. So an O-class star's surface temperature will be in the range of 25,000 to 50,000 Kelvin, which is almost 4 to 9 times hotter than the sun. While an M-class star's temperature will be around 3000 Kelvin, which is much less than that of our suns. And there's a common misconception about the color of the star and its temperature. I mean, I don't know if it's common, but personally, when I was young, I used to think that the redder a star, the hotter it is. But it's actually the other way around. The red stars are the cool ones, and the hottest ones are actually blue in color. And even within these 7 classes I mentioned before, there are 10 subclasses. So our sun is actually a G2 type star. And it was only a few years later when another scientist named Cecilia Payne joined Annie and her colleagues, published her work Stellar Astrophysics, which is still regarded as one of the best written works in the field of astrophysics, in which she concluded that unlike on Earth, hydrogen and helium are the dominant elements of the sun and stars. And apart from the fact that star spectra aren't precisely continuous spectra, there's another issue while measuring the temperature. That is, there's material in between the stars. The material is usually dust. I mean, it's a lot similar to the Earth's upper atmosphere. Just like how blue light scatters more than red light. I mean, it's due to the presence of particles of dust in atmosphere, right? And when this phenomenon happens in space, it is known as interstellar reddening. So, Krishna, why didn't you tell us about the brightness of these stars?
Sure, why not? So, as we know, stars differ in how bright they are. Hot star shines brighter than a cool star. A large star shines brighter than a small star. But astronomers describe stars' brightness in terms of magnitude and luminosity. Let's look at the magnitude first. The magnitude of a star is based on a scale more than 2000 years old devised by a Greek astronomer named Hipparchus around 125 BC. What he did was number the group of stars based on their brightness as seen from Earth. The brightest ones were called first magnitude stars, the next brightest were second magnitude, and so on up to 6th magnitude, the faintest visible ones. Nowadays, astronomers refer to stars' brightness as viewed from Earth as its apparent magnitude, as in the brightness we see from Earth. For instance, let's take a hot large star that is very distant from Earth, does not look very bright, right? But the sun looks very bright because it is so close to Earth. Yet, since the distance between Earth and star can affect the light one sees from it, hence, we now describe the actual brightness of star using the term absolute magnitude, which is characterized as what its apparent magnitude would be if it was around 32.6 light years from Earth. Now, coming to the luminosity. Luminosity basically is the power of star, the rate at which it emits energy. Although power is generally measured in watts, for instance, let's take sun's luminosity, it is 400 trillion watts. The luminosity of star is usually measured in terms of luminosity of sun. For instance, Alpha Centauri A is about 1.3 times as luminous as sun. Now you might be wondering how to figure out luminosity from absolute magnitude. For that, one must calculate the difference of pi on the absolute magnitude scale, which is equivalent to a factor of 100 on the luminosity scale. For example, a star with absolute magnitude of 1 is 100 times as luminous as the star with absolute magnitude of 6. While absolute magnitude scale is astronomers' best effort to analyze the brightness of star, but there are still a couple of constraints associated with that. Firstly, star can emit radiation in form, say, ranging high energy X-ray to low energy infrared radiation. Contingent upon the type of star, they could be bright in some of the wavelengths and dimmer in others. To address this issue, one must specify the wavelength they are using to make the absolute magnitude measurement. And another key limitation is sensitivity of the instrument we are using to make that measurement. While most of the stars have consistent brightness, there are still more than 100,000 known and cataloged variable stars. Even our own sun is variable, varying its energy output by about 0.1% during its 11 years old. Variable stars are either intrinsic or extrinsic. Now, when I say intrinsic, it's meaning the luminosity changes due to the features such as expansion, contraction, eruption, or pulsation. an extrinsic meaning that star or planet passes in front of star and blocks the light, or that the change is due to some stellar rotation. Stars can also change in luminosity over time. The North Star, Polaris as we know it, for example, could have been as much as 4.6 times brighter in the ancient time than it was today. Polaris is also part of class of Cepheid variables, which are extremely luminous stars that have short pulses. Other types of intrinsic variable stars include cataclysmic variable, which brighten due to outbursts such as during supernova explosion, or others are elliptic variables whose brightness varies during eruption on the surface or the combination with interstellar matter. And the extrinsic variable stars include eclipsing binary star or rotating stars, such as pulsars, the core of supernova whose electromagnetic radiation is only visible when the beam is directed at Earth. So that was about brightness. And as we know, there is a relation between mass and luminosity. So why don't you tell us more about the mass of stars?
Indeed, I'd love to talk about the size and mass of stars. The size of stars is usually measured in terms of the radius of our sun by astronomers. Alpha Centauri A, for example, has a radius of 1.05 solar radii. The brightness of a star is determined by its size. The brightness of a light source is related to its radius squared. For example, if two stars had the same temperature but one was twice as wide as the other, the former would be four times brighter. We can break down the types of stars we have by size range, and what we find are five generic classes. Neutron stars. These supernova leftovers have a mass of 1 to 3 suns but are squeezed into a single massive atomic nucleus. Because of their smaller size, they continue to produce radiation, only in trace levels. The typical neutron star is between 20 to 100 kilometers in diameter. White dwarf stars are generated when a sun-like star runs out of helium fuel in its core, causing the outer layers to fly away while the inner layers compresses. The white dwarf star has between 0.5 and 1.4 times the mass of the sun, but has only around 10,000 kilometers in diameter and is composed of severely compacted atoms. The red dwarf sun-like stars and the blue behemoths we discussed before are all main sequence stars. They cover a vast range of diameters ranging from 100,000 kilometers to 30 million kilometers. Although even the largest one, if it is replaced by the sun, would not swallow Mercury. Red giant stars. So what happens when you run out of hydrogen in your core? If you are not a red dwarf star, gravitational contraction will heat your core to the point where you start fusing helium into carbon. Oh, and the fusing helium into carbon produces far more energy than regular hydrogen fusion, leading your star to explode in size. To keep your star stable, the outward force radiation at the star's edge must balance the inward force gravitation. There's a lot greater outward force simply requires a much larger star. Red giants typically have a diameter from 100 to 150 million kilometers, huge enough to swallow Mercury, Venus, and possibly Earth. Supergiant stars, the most massive stars, will begin fusing heavier elements in their cores, such as carbon, oxygen, and even silicon and sulfur. In addition to helium, these stars are on their way to becoming supernovas and or black holes. But before they do, they swell to enormous sizes that can reach a billion kilometers in diameter or more. These are greatest stars such as Betelgeuse, and if they were to replace the sun, they would swallow all the rocky planets, the asteroid belt, and the larger ones would even swallow Jupiter. Okay, coming to the mass, astronomers express a star's mass in terms of their solar mass, which is the mass of our sun. Alpha Centauri A, for example, has a mass of 1.08 solar masses. Because of their densities, varies. Stars with equal masses may not be the same size. Sirius B, for example, has nearly the same mass as the sun but is 90,000 times denser, making it only a fraction of its diameter. The surface temperature of a star is affected by its mass. The more mass a star has, the hotter the interior of the star will be and the higher the pressure will be in the core. Hydrogen atoms are more quickly converted into helium when temperatures and pressures are higher. The more mass a star has, the faster it will convert hydrogen fuel into helium.
Sure, Rohit, but before that, let me ask you something. What, according to you, is a metal?
Okay, according to me, metal is a good conductor of heat and electricity. It is malleable, it's ductile, it's lustrous, and it's sonorous.
Yeah, exactly, that's right. But according to an astronomer, any element higher than hydrogen and helium is termed as a metal. And that brings us to another very important feature of stars, which is called metallicity, which tells us about the abundance of higher elements in the star.
Okay, so how it is calculated?
Yeah, metallicity is the ratio of the number of atoms of iron to the number of atoms of hydrogen per unit volume. And the stars can be classified into three categories based on metallicity. Stars having high metallicity are known as population 1 stars, and these are usually the younger stars, and population 2 stars are the ones with low metallicity and are comparatively older than the population 1 stars. And there are some hypothetical stars having no metal content at all, which are called population 3 stars. And there is no real existence of such stars ever found. And we just assume such stars could have been formed in the early universe. And these stars are supposed to be extremely massive and hot.
So why is it that younger stars have higher metallicity?
That's a good question. It's quite interesting to note that younger stars have higher metallicity compared to the older stars. Just imagine this, alright? 3 minutes after the Big Bang, the first hydrogen atom came into existence. And after some time, helium was formed by collisions. Hence, there was only hydrogen and helium formed in the beginning of the universe. So obviously, the stars formed initially were made up of only hydrogen and helium, and very few other elements formed later in the star's core due to high temperature and pressure. Right? Later on, when supernova explosions started to happen, more higher elements started to come into existence. So what do you think happens next when new stars are formed? The new stars are already polluted with the remains of the supernova explosions that include richer elements, right? So this is why younger stars have more metallicity.
Okay, so that was a quite good explanation for my questions for metallicity. And on the whole, we discussed a very good understanding. I think our listeners gained a very good understanding of characteristics of stars by now. Okay, so this was it for the episode, guys. And we'll meet you in the next episode. But hold on, we have an interesting question for you. On which of these factors do habitable zone around a star depends? Okay, so we'll be entertaining answer these questions in our Instagram DMs. Okay, the user ID is already mentioned in the episode description and in the podcast description. We'll also be entertaining all the answers on email IDs on our LinkedIn page. And waiting for the answers, we'll be giving the answer in the next episode itself. So till then, stay tuned. Bye-bye.